Thanks to Darren and all the 2FM crew for driving us through the afternoon live from the Ploughing Championships. We might go down there ourselves next year. It's Wednesday, the 17th of September, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7 o'clock, Paul Corry and Katie Kirk are in studio to discuss the latest from the UEFA Champions League and the World Athletics Championships. Plus, Michael Moynihan will be along to discuss his new book, More Than a Game, the GAA and where it's going. If you want to get in touch, text us on 51552, WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200 or we're on X at GameOn2FM.
2FM's Game On.
Now, welcome along. It's a busy day in sport. Lots of live action, and that is what we love. There was cricket today, but Ireland have lost to England by 4 wickets in the first of 3 T20 internationals after Ireland were put into bat first at Malahide. Half centuries from Harry Tector and Lorcan Tucker helped them to 196 from their 20 overs. England hit 197 with 20 deliveries to spare. And the second match will take place at the same venue on Friday. Lots going on in the world of football as well. Match day one of the Champions League continues today. Liverpool will start out with a game against Atletico Madrid at Anfield, and there might even be a sighting of Alexander Isak. He is expected to make his Liverpool debut, and that game is going to be live on RTE2 television, kicking off at 8 o'clock. There's a couple of games already underway. Olympiacos are playing Paphos, and it is 0-0 there. It's also scoreless between Slavia Prague and Bodo Glimt. Paul Corry is with us. He's going to talk us through all of that, but we are going to start off with the athletics because it was a huge day for Andrew Coscarin, but he had to settle for 12th place in the final of the men's 1500 metres at the World Championships in Tokyo. Katie is with us. Katie, it was probably a disappointing enough day for him, but still, I thought he equipped himself pretty well. What did you think?
I think given how the race panned out, Josh Kerr going backwards, seems like he maybe had a little bit of an injury that he picked up. I'm sure he's looking at that and he is kicking himself. The eventual winner, Nader from Portugal, I was looking at some of the stats and we were discussing it before we came on air. I think it just shows how much someone can improve in a short period of time. And people can maybe use that and think, you know, I finished 10th or 12th at the last World Championships at the Olympics. Nader didn't even make the final of the Olympics last year. And there's been a massive shift in the types of athletes and who we're seeing in this men's 1500. So it really was wide open. And I think for Andrew, it's not that it's a missed opportunity, but he'll definitely take some learnings from it.
Absolutely. Well, let's hear from him now and then we're going to go through how the race panned out because it was so dramatic. He was speaking with Darren Frehill.
Well, Andrew, how do you feel that went for you today?
Yeah, I think that was a bit of a disappointment. I would have preferred to finish a bit higher up, and I think I was capable of finishing a bit higher up, but it just wasn't my day today.
And tactically, what was the plan out there today?
Yeah, I think ideally I would have been in a better position with 400 to go. That's just when everyone got rolling and I was just a little bit too far back. So I think my last 400 was pretty good, but I was just behind too many guys to kind of get anywhere. So then I just ended up working quite hard to get up to near the front, and then just kind of like tied up a little bit with the last 100. But I think I was always trying to get up to the front of the race, but I think a lot of bodies in the way, and just, yeah, it wasn't the day today. But I think, yeah, I was happy to get into the final, big step forward for me. So I learned a lot from that. So hopefully making some adjustments going forward, and I'll be in the mix.
Josh Kerr pulled up and maybe 3-4 guys, big names, you know, not there.
Yeah.
Was an opportunity lost, do you think, to maybe get further up there? And
Possibly, but I think there's so much depth in the 1500 metres at the moment that everyone who gets to that final is good. But yeah, there's, say, Jakob was missing and one or two other guys that are good, but I think there's so much depth there. When one guy doesn't make it, there's another guy to take the spot straight away. It's a very strong event right now.
You've taken a huge step forward making this final. This is one of the marquee events at the championships. Yeah. What have you learned from the experience?
I think that I got a lot right this time, so I think we can keep those adjustments going forward. And I think in the final there, it was just a tactical thing. It was just being in a good spot with 400 to go. Like, if the legs felt pretty good, my last 400 was pretty good, so it was just being a little bit higher up. And that's possibly positioning yourself there right at the start, or having a point in the race where you get there. And I think in this particular race, because there was 14 guys rather than 12 in a final, it's usually 12, so there was more guys in the way, so that made it a bit more difficult. So it's probably in the first 200 you want to get yourself up to top 5, top 6 position, and then when everything kicks off with 400 to go, you're in the mix, and that's when it's a slow race. So next year, going back, if some of the guys who like to make it a bit faster might be in the race, and it might be a 3:27 race again, so those taxes are out the window. So you just have to adjust as you go. But if presented with a race like that, I think it's getting to a good position with 400 to go.
And being there in that final, like, what will you take from that? Has that given you confidence?
Yeah. The fact that I can get there, and I think I felt quite good in the heats and the semis, and even felt quite good in the final there as well. So the physiological side of things, I think, is everything's perfect right now. It's that positioning in races. And in fairness, I think I tried to do the right things there, and there was just too many bodies, really. So it was just one of those things where I was unlucky on the day, I suppose, and next time maybe it'll open up a bit better.
So was Andrew Coskren speaking to Darren Frell a little bit earlier on today, and you could tell by listening to him how disappointed he is. And often I think people don't realise the achievement of even getting to a world final. It's absolutely amazing. But it seems like it was maybe a bit of a lack of experience at that level. Just listening to him there, he said himself he felt like he was doing the right things but could have maybe positioned himself better. Does it just take a bit of time?
I definitely think there's some people who have better racing brains than others. And I wouldn't say that Andrew is necessarily bad at that by any means, but it could just be he hasn't been in a lot of finals. He's made some Europeans final. This is his first global final. And I think that the more experience he gets at that level, the better. The other thing, Marie, you have to bear in mind is that, as Andrew said in his interview, the big hitters that usually take it out were not there. You didn't have the likes of Jakob Ingebrigtsen to have maybe a race that was a bit more predictable. I think there was a lot of things going on there that he just maybe couldn't control. I watched the race back, and Andrew was actually not in a bad position at 200 to go, but he made the decision to run quite wide at that point, and the athletes on his inside were then moving a little bit quicker than he was. So then that means that by the time you get to the top of the home straight, you're maybe not in the position that you want. And then if you look at the eventual winner, Nader of Portugal, he was tucked in on the inside in about 5th or 6th place in that home straight, and that is exactly where you want to be. He actually ended up having to run quite wide in the end, but kind of hanging back a little bit is not necessarily a bad thing. But I think Andrew was obviously just a little bit too far back to make an impact in the final 100 metres.
Okay, and for anyone who didn't see the race, it was absolute chaos from start to finish, with Josh Kerr getting injured. It was
It was hard to tell what happened to him. I think that he, like, fair play to him, he ran on, he limped through the rest of the race. I mean,
Would he do that? Because, I mean, if you're after getting, his accolades was stood on. We haven't got full confirmation of it yet, but why would you put yourself through that?
I don't know. To me, it almost looked like he actually, something popped or went as well. It wasn't necessarily just like a physical, like something that had just happened or a knock in the race. Very hard to know. I don't know if it's just like his own personal determination that he would want to see out the race. That's what I was thinking. It was a bit strange, but maybe he thought, I always think, I was thinking about this the other day, you know, like that term DeLulu, I feel like there needs to be a bit of delusion there. Maybe he thought he could get back onto them. That definitely was not going to happen for anyone else watching that, but I feel like in your head you might think, right, I can get back onto them. And Josh Kerr is the ultimate competitor. He's shown that time and time again. But watching his semi-final 2 days prior, to me, Marie, he really looked like he'd pushed a little bit too hard.
So what about the finish then? And look, the expectation was that if it wasn't Josh Kerr, that maybe Jake Whiteman might go out and win it. And he obviously, it didn't work out for him. Then there was, of course, Niels Laros as well. And like, again, it didn't really work out for him. And the person that it did work out for, who you mentioned, Adar, like, nobody expected him to win. So what exactly went on in that race?
I think that it's all about, for 1500 metres, it's about pace management and also positioning. And as I said, Nader was just in the perfect position at the top of that 100 metre straight. He probably has expended the least amount of energy running around there. And one of the reasons Andrew Coskren might be kicking himself a little bit, I looked at the stats so we can compare their head-to-heads, who's won how many times. I think they've met 9 times in their careers. Nader's beaten Andrew 5 times and he's beaten him 4. So if you put it into that perspective of, you know, they're actually on a similar level to
some
degree.
That's probably what frustrated Andrew Coskren the most, is that, like, somebody who is at his level, like, you're not talking about people who have won Olympic, European, World Championship gold medals here. It's somebody that he would see as being a beatable opponent.
Absolutely. And I think that Nader's finishes in the last year in particular, fourth at those World Indoors, slightly better than Andrew, but still not beyond the realm of kind of possibility. He was only 10th at the European Outdoors last year, 8th in the Olympic semi-finals last year, 12th in the World Champs in 2023.
It sounds like there's hope for us all here, Katie.
I think so.
Right, well, look, he's got Andrew Cosgrove, he's got a real bright future. He's still so young and he has just shown that he belongs on that world stage. So we'll be following his career, that's for sure. So as these championships progress, it was quite an off day on the Irish front. Andrew taking centre stage, but still there was a lot of other big races as well. And I think a lot of people were tuning in to RTÉ TV today to see Gout Run. So for people who don't know who he is, tell us a little bit about this young 17-year-old sprinter.
So he is really tipped to be the next Usain Bolt. Has like quite
no
a
pressure.
And Usain Bolt has been at these championships. We saw him during the men's 100 metre final. He was very enthusiastic. So I'm sure he'll be hoping to tune in. Gout is, he has quite a similar style. He's tall. It's quite rangy. Very Bolt-esque in that way. And I think the men's 200 is one of those events that, it's not that it's wide open. I definitely think there are some new challengers to potentially knock Noah Lyles off his perch a little bit. And we also heard from Alexander Ogando today on the RTÉ coverage with David Gillick. He managed to grab an interview with him. And I think Alexander, you know, maybe he thought he was talking English, but it was a bilingual. And I think Gillick is going to have to brush up on his Spanish for the next round. It was very funny if you want to go back and watch that. But lots of big hitters in the men's 200 metres. But Gout is one of the most exciting prospects.
Yeah, he really is. And I think like his whole story and bursting onto the stage and being so young have really captured everyone's imagination. So I can't wait to see how he goes. Another race that was so chaotic and so dramatic was the women's 3,000 metre steeplechase, Katie. Like, again, coming into that home stretch, it was really hard to tell what was going to happen, but it ended up in an unexpected runner who took the title.
Yeah, so I think that the women's steeple is one of those events that has really progressed in the last few years. Previously, we were seeing, you know, medals won around the 9-minute mark, but Faith Cheritich came through in 8:51.59 in a new championship record to take the win. And that was actually 5 seconds ahead of Yavi, who has won multiple medals on the global stage as well. And Almayu, just they came through kind of quite quickly, and she also ran a PB, and there was a few national records in there as well. But the women's steeplechase, I think, is something, an event that's really in its development stage. I don't think we quite know just what those females are capable of yet, but it's definitely one to keep an eye on for the future.
Yeah, definitely. And Cheritich is someone as well who is just rising all of the time, and she's still only 21, which is absolutely amazing. And she got the job done today. So tomorrow is a big day for the Irish athletes, well, for the men's 800 metres in particular. So tell us what's in store.
So the men's 800 semi-finals, we have two athletes in that. I'm not sure at the start of the championships if that's something we would have predicted. So it's absolutely fantastic to have two men in those semi-finals. And particularly the style in which Cian McPhillips progressed, I think, has just really impressed everyone. He looks so in control and smooth in his heat. He won his heat. And he is going into those semi-finals, qualifying 8th overall. And I know that some people look at that and think, oh yeah, like a chance for the final. But obviously there's some people in there who are able to turn it up, who are able to
maybe they're pacing themselves through the rounds.
Yeah, but to be honest, from watching it, there was actually a few surprises in those heats. I definitely think that some of the American big hitters, I'm thinking of Hopple in particular, who was in Cian McPhillips' heat, he didn't look so good. And I think that the heat is potentially having a little bit of an impact in some people's finishes, but Cian looked like he coped with it very well. The news that came out today and for those men's semi-finals, yesterday we said on the show with Shane that Mark had an impossible semi-final draw, but those have actually been redrawn.
Why would they do that?
So sometimes that can be a complaint from a nation. So An athlete in particular probably was someone in Mark's heat, because they had Ben Pattinson, a British guy who has won a medal at a global level, Marco Arop, I think silver medalist last year in the Olympics, plus Wen Yanyi, who won the Olympics last year. So I think it was just particularly stacked. So sometimes in that scenario, they might go back and decide to redraw based on a complaint from a federation, like a national federation.
And it's great then when an Irish athlete benefits.
Well, I don't know. It's one of those things, you're swapping out someone else. Yeah. So Wanyonyi has...
So everybody in that level is going to be really good anyway.
So Wanyonyi has now moved to the third heat, which doesn't affect Kay McPhillips either. So that's also good news. But tough draws all round. It is first two and two fastest to the final. And I suppose one of the other challenges of the 800 is that they only take eight people to the final, one person per lane. So it's a little bit less than the 15 that makes the qualification a little bit tough. So if either Mark or Kane can make the final, that would be like a spectacular... I can't understand how that, like, a spectacular achievement.
Okay, well, I'm a very positive mindset, so I'm going to go both of them. Sure, why not? So anything else to look forward to tomorrow, Katie?
I mean, there's plenty of action on, but if we are looking a little bit further ahead to the Irish in action, Kate O'Connor is going to be kicking off her World Championships bid on Friday morning Irish time. So I think that that's definitely something that we can get excited for. And we are going to be previewing her event a little bit in the programme tomorrow. So I feel like if you want to get excited for more Irish in action, there's actually, I think, going to be no Irish on the telly on Thursday, I believe. Or maybe Friday. I can't remember. There's one day we don't have too many people on, and maybe tomorrow. But yeah, Kate is going to be starting on Friday, so we're looking forward to that.
Absolutely. Katie, thank you so much for coming in. I hope you've been enjoying all of the athletics coverage. It's been great and lovely to see the Irish as well on that world stage and holding their own. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us because Paul Carey has been glued to Slavia Prague and blew up Bodo Glimt. It is 1-0 to Slavia Prague, and it is still scoreless between Olympiacos and Paphos. We'll have more, plus we'll be previewing all of the other big games and last night's, and we're reflecting on last night's action after these.
RTE 2FM. This is 2FM's Game On.
Welcome back. Paul Carey is with me in studio. Paul, I did mention that you were intently watching Slavia Prague and Bodo Glimt, and that it's 1-0 to Slavia Prague just before the break. 39 minutes played there, and scoreless in the other A-League game, Olympiacos and Paphos.
It's a bit disrespectful to say, but If you told me they were Europa League or Conference League games, I'd well believe you.
Well, I was going to ask you, what's the standard like there now?
I mean, it's hard to measure, isn't it? Because they're going up against one another, and it's hard to pit them against the top teams in the Champions League. But if you compare the football to maybe what I was watching last night from a Real Madrid, it's chalk and cheese, to be honest with you.
Well, I'm going to take that, but I'm going to throw back at you that Karabag beat Benfica 3-2 and...
Caravag are decent though.
But would you not be putting them more in this category rather than the Benfica, Juventus, Real Madrid, Borussia Dortmund, Arsenal, PSG?
Yeah, I still think, okay, we look at this league phase within the Champions League, okay? There are 36 teams involved within the league phase. It then gets whittled down to kind of the round before the last 16. So you only lose, what is it, 11 teams from the league phase? I would expect that Karabag and the four teams playing tonight will all exit the competition at the league phase. But Carabag, I mean, fantastic result. We saw a lot of them in the over the course of two legs when they played Shells. They were pretty impressive. Shells did well, I thought, in Talca Park when they played them. What a result that is. They were 2-0 behind against Benfica last night and ended up winning 3-2. And no surprise that Bruno Lage, ex-Wolves manager, was sacked as Benfica manager last night. And they are tipping Jose Mourinho with that job.
That would be either a match made in heaven or a match made in hell. It'll be one extreme or the next.
Yeah,
just given his past association with their biggest rivals, I can imagine that it'll be probably tempestuous at times.
Yeah, loyalty doesn't come into it with Joe saying managerial jobs. If you think like Chelsea and Tottenham,
I always think
Chelsea, Manchester United, and then you're talking about Porto and Benfica.
Anytime he's looking for a new job, he appears on the telly. So he kind of will do an interview, usually with Sky Sports, somewhere along the lines, and it's a come and get me.
Mm. He must love it. In fairness to him, like he's been around to Benfica now. He's obviously with Tottenham. He's had a couple of clubs over the last few years. He's not out of work for too long. There's always people who take a punt on Jose.
Yeah, well, I can see why. But he probably will have a tough enough... Well, I suppose, look, it's they are a team of high quality, but just trying to pick them back up again after losing to Karabag.
And if he does take the job, the first game in the Champions League is against Chelsea and Stamford Bridge. They play Chelsea, then they play Newcastle in the Champions League. They have Leverkusen. They have a couple of tasty ones, Ajax, Napoli. So it's very difficult to see them getting out of that league phase. They also play Juventus and finish with Real Madrid. So a couple of his old teams, if he does take that job, and obviously the first trip would be to the bridge.
Okay, well, that would be nice and dramatic. But look, you're talking about the different levels, but for the most part, we do have the best teams in Europe playing against each other regularly. Like, they're good fixtures, Paul.
Yeah, they are, particularly at the beginning of the competition. I think as you get later in the league phase and teams are almost guaranteed that spot in the last 16, you will start to see shuffling of the pack. Teams are still getting used to this new format. But if you think back to last year, I think it was Liverpool were right out in front with Barcelona, and they were able to rotate a couple of players as they got to the tail end of the competition. So I don't feel as if there's massive jeopardy.
PSG struggled
for the biggest teams. PSG lost a lot of games last year
over the line,
and they only just about got into that playoff round, and of course they went on and they probably had a more difficult route because of that, because they had that extra fixture. They had a very difficult draw. I can't remember who they got in that playoff round, and then they played obviously Liverpool, they played Arsenal, and then onto the final. Yeah, it's a more difficult route, but I also feel like the top teams, so the teams from England, the teams from Spain, maybe excluding Atletico Bilbao and Villarreal, and the top teams in Italy should all be making it out, even if they lose one or two games. But you're right, Marie, at the beginning of the competition, even when you look forward to tonight, there's some really tasty games to look forward to.
Of course there is. Well, like, it'll get us through the winter, Paul Corrie. Don't you knock it at all. Let's just have a quick chat about last night. Arsenal getting the job done against Athletic Club, for Arteta scoring the two goals, getting that bit of momentum, seeing that there's plenty of competition for places within his squad as well, looking at Martinelli and the impact that he had, and then maybe Eze finding it a little bit trickier than he probably expected. But good night at the office?
Yeah, it certainly was. I would have expected them to go there and win last night. Bilbao had just been beaten by Alaves and Osasuna, Osasuna in their last two games. So not surprised that Arsenal went there and won. I think what's most impressive about Arsenal at this time of the year is there was no Martin Odegaard, there was no Saliba, there was no Kai Havertz, there was no Ben White. If you took all of those players out of the Arsenal team last year, I'm not sure you would have gone there with the same confidence. And that's a testament to the work that they've done with the squad and bringing in extra players in Zubimendi and Gyökeres. Even the young fella at the back who they've brought in from Valencia, Mosquera, he looks very, very accomplished and can slot into that back four. So there's more beef about the team. Eze and Madueke, more minutes in their legs. And there's been a lot of talk from Arteta in the post-match press conference talking about the finishes coming off the bench. I thought Martinelli took his goal particularly well, and he did super for Trossard's goal also. So Arsenal started the season very impressively, Marie. I mean, you look at it over the course of the six games they've played, the five games they've played, they've played four in the league and one in the Champions League. They've only conceded one goal, and that was Dom McSabalai's free kick that rocketed into the top corner. So they are a very, very tough nut to break down. Still feel like going forward, they somewhat have the handbrake on, and people are asking for them to be a little bit more expansive. I think that will come when you get Odegaard and Saka back in the team.
Spurs beat Villarreal by 1-0, and they looked a little bit frail up top, but defensively quite good.
And I think Tottenham fans will be happy with that. There was chaos anytime you watch Tottenham, particularly in the tail end of the season last year under Postecoglou. A lot of that was due to the fact that they had no Romero and no Mickey van de Ven. They look a far more solid outfit with those players in the team, but they also look a far more solid team on the basis of the work that Thomas Frank has done with them. Much more cohesive when they go about pressing the ball, and the more than comfortable kind of sit back in their shape, and they've already kept four clean sheets as a result of that. So they certainly look a more tight-knit unit than they did last year. There's still a lot of work, like you mentioned, to do going forward and see can they be that creative force. I think he'll do okay there, but I don't expect that Tottenham will be challenging in a Champions League or a Premier League this season. I still feel when you look at the squad, they are quite a number of players short of that. But Thomas Frank is certainly getting credit in the bank with the Tottenham fans.
You mentioned watching Real Madrid and they beat Marseille 2-1, had to come from behind two Mbappe penalties. But the big talking point is Trent Alexander-Arnold off after just a few minutes with injury. It's not really working out that well for him in Real Madrid, is it?
Yeah, well, he's been in and out with Dani Carvajal in that right back position, and it was a bit of a straight pass that was played to him last night. He turned and you could see he just accelerated 4 or 5 yards and the hand went towards the hamstring, and that's never a good sign. He came off after 5 minutes. The initial reports, by the soundings of things, is it's not too bad, and you would kind of hope it's not too bad, because settling into the new club and settling into a new city, like, really that becomes an easier transition if you're playing games and you're playing well and in a winning side. So you would hope to see him back on the pitch soon. It was a funny night at the office. I watched that game last night because I just absolutely love De Zerbi's teams. They are chaotic in everything they do when they go and press the ball and the way they try play out from the back. And there's always chances and there are always goals. And he had a really sort of misfit team last night. You had Aubameyang up top. You had Matt O'Reilly, who's on loan from Brighton. Mason Greenwood, you have Ndogbia, mm-hmm. you have Hoiberg, who they picked up on a free transfer, Emerson, who was left back at West Ham. So you don't really know what to expect, but they ran Real Madrid pretty close last night. Danny Carvajal certainly didn't help, getting sent off after 72 minutes, moment of madness, headbutt of the goalkeeper. But when you've got quality in your team, ultimately you will create a lot of chances. They could have scored more. Mbappe took his penalties well. The second one was robbery, if you ask me. It was never handball worthy of giving a penalty, but they look as if they are growing into what Xavi Alonso wants from them. Really, really impressed with the young Mastuano, or however you pronounce his name. Just turned, I think it's 18 years of age. Argentinian, playing for Argentina already. Very impressive on the wing. Obviously still a little bit raw, but lovely left foot, very creative. Linked up very well with Mbappe and Rodrigo in that final third. So they're a side that I think will improve as the season goes on. Obviously likes of Huijsen coming into the team will start to understand what Alonso wants out of them. But there's so much quality in that squad that they shouldn't have any problems getting through this league phase.
Okay, let's turn our attention to tonight, because there's some huge games. Liverpool and Atletico will definitely be garnering a huge amount of attention because people are curious about Alexander Isak and whether or not he is going to play. Let's hear now from the Liverpool manager Arne Slot on Isak and also Wirtz's form.
There's definitely a chance because he's in the squad. So then there's a chance to play, but it's... I would normally always say 99.9% sure, but I can say it's 100% sure that he will not play 90 minutes. But he's part of the squad, so it's already a Champions League game to look forward to. But if people look forward to his playing time, that could mean that could happen as well. The only thing that is sure is that he would not play 90, and all the rest you will see tomorrow.
Obviously, we look at Florian Wirtz and the switch that he's made coming to Liverpool, and I think there's probably an argument to say that we've not seen the best of him just yet. I think there were flashes in the second half, at least against Burnley once again. What do you put that down to, though, the fact that we've not seen the best of Florian just yet, and what kind of adjustment is he having to make?
I put that down to Bournemouth, I put that down to Newcastle, I put that down to Arsenal, and because there's so much focus on our new signings, because especially the pundits that favour not us but some other clubs in the country that cannot stop talking about 450 million, I repeat 450 million, I repeat 450 million, but they always forget the 300 million that we've sold for. And these players that we've brought in are indeed a lot of money, but they are playing now together with players that are worth same amounts of money. So yes, if we want to strengthen the squad, we need almost to spend that much money, because then they are, if we sell Dominic Soboslai tomorrow, he would be worth 100 million as well. So there's so much focus on Florian, but the ones that have stayed behind, still in the team, haven't scored 4 goals or 12 assists as well. So he's been part of a team, Florian, that is on top of the league, that won 4 games. He's part of the team that won against Newcastle, that won against Arsenal, where the team of last season didn't win away at Newcastle, didn't win at home against Arsenal. And he's part of a team that's number one in the league at the moment.
Yeah, Liverpool have maybe not been as fluid, Paul, as people expected, but maybe is it a case that if they get a few more games like this Atletico one, like more European games, that things will start clicking, because clearly they have the personnel.
Yeah, they do. And I think you need to give some of those players time. Like, they have changed a lot of personnel within that side. You think the two full-backs in Kerkhage and Frimpong are coming into the team. You've Wirtz, Ekitike, Isak. So there's a lot of players that you're trying to blood in as you try to continue winning games. And if they do deserve credit, maybe it's not in the performances, but it's in their ability to churn out results. And I would expect tonight would be another case of that. Atletico Madrid haven't really started La Liga too well. I think when you look at their side, pace is probably something that's really going to threaten them at the back, and you've got abundance of that in Gakpo, Ekitike, Salah, and I would expect that Isak will probably come off the bench and play the last 30 minutes of that game. So they're doing well. Maybe a couple of question marks, particularly from a defensive perspective. They looked very vulnerable earlier on in the year when they played against Bournemouth. Transitions, counter-attacks, probably short of a centre-half there. That would be my main concern with Liverpool, but anytime they play, they create so many chances that they look like they're going to score so many goals and score enough goals to win games. And ultimately, I think that's what will happen tonight. I don't see that Atletico rear guard having enough to kind of shut up shop and see out 90 minutes without conceding a few chances against that really threatening
That game,
Liverpool forward line,
is on RTÉ television. Another huge one then is Bayern Munich and your beloved Chelsea, Paul.
Yeah, this one will be interesting. I mean, Chelsea were okay on the weekend against Brentford. I mean, you look at the changes that they made at halftime the other night. Reece James came on. Cucurella came on, Cole Palmer came on after 56 minutes. When you start to blow that sort of quality into the team, it makes such a difference to the level of their performance. And I expect, if fit, all of those players will probably play tonight. And if they can do that, I think you've got a chance against Bayern Munich. You look at the Bayern team now, there's a couple of 30-year-olds and the likes of Gnabry, Goretzka, Kimmich, Kane's pushed on a bit. I'm not sure they have the same sort of energy to their play that maybe they did 2 or 3 years ago, where you went to the Allianz Arena, it was back up against the wall, fullbacks pushed high, blistering pace out wide. I don't see that within this team with Bayern Munich. And I think Chelsea have a lot of players that, if you come out and attack them, can really hurt you. They probably struggle when teams sit deep. The likes of Brentford, two banks of four, maybe don't have that creativity when Palmer's not in the team to go and cut you open. But if you come at them, I think they've got pace in the likes of Estevao, Neto, João Pedro, who can go and hurt you. So we're still learning about this Chelsea team, still understanding where they're going to pitch in against the top teams in Europe and in the Premier League. But I think when they have everybody fit and you have those players back in the team, I think they will cause a lot of teams problems in this competition.
Okay, so there are two really exciting games coming up at 8 o'clock and two other ones as well. Ajax against Inter Milan and PSG and Atalanta. So lots to watch if you are sitting at home this evening and interested in seeing the big teams in action. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us. Paul is going nowhere. You might even have some team news for us before the programme ends. But after this break, we're going to be hearing from Michael Moynihan about his book, More Than a Game, The GAA and Where It's Going.
This is 2FM Game On
GAA.
Now, I am delighted to say that we have author Michael Moynihan in studio to join us to talk about his new book, More Than a Game, The GAA and Where It's Going. Michael, you're so very welcome.
Thanks, Marie.
This seems like a very timely book because there are a lot of things happening both in society and in the GAA. So it's good to have something like this to go to have a look and to get some analysis on where things might be heading. It's essential reading. For you, though, what prompted you to write a book like this?
Well, I think you kind of put your finger on it, the way society and the GAA interact without being too kind of pointy-headed about it. I suppose where it really came from were a couple of questions that kind of kept popping up in conversations I had with people. Basically, what is the GAA for? Is it about elite intercounty sport? Is it about participation and getting kids through the gate? Is it really a property organisation with thousands of premises all over the country? Or is it now a media company providing and content on its own and with other companies? And I suppose what I really want to say is it one of those things? Is it all of those things? And how do those questions intersect with each other?
Yeah, they're important topics as well, because I suppose with the way society is changing as well, that the GAA needs to change to fit in with it. Did you find the answers to many of these questions, do you feel?
No. Well, in fairness, people were very generous with their time and really engaged with the questions. And there were some really interesting answers. Someone like Tom Ryan, the Director General of the GAA, to be fair, really engaged with. He actually answered the question for himself. He said the GAA has to be about participation, about getting kids in, because the kids are the future and they're the clubs. The clubs become the counties and so on and so forth. So in that sense, he was willing to answer the question. He was willing to put his name to an answer, that put it that way. The other side of that, though, is, you know, where is the GAA going? Can it just focus on participation? Not really, because the premises have to be in place for the participation. How are the premises put in place? Well, media has something to do with that, because you're monetizing your content without using too much marketing speak in the form of the games. So they're still intersecting. But I think if you have a primary focus, say participation, that informs everything else then that you do.
You mentioned the media there, and it is quite a complex part of the GAA, and it's probably a complex relationship. And I suppose to read just how poor it is, is the reality that I guess people maybe aren't really aware of. And I think as well, seeing Jim Gavin being interviewed by non-sports people in the last week or so, sports journalists made me realise just how different the GAA media's approach is to a lot of the stars and the people. But just in terms of that relationship, do you think it's going to get better?
Can I just say that's very delicately put about Jim Gavin's relationship with GAA journalists. I think, as you say, when you're inside the tent and you're part of it and you're complaining, obviously people don't pay any attention to that because it's just, you know, a sports writer complaining about access to players. But there's a significant issue there in the sense that, you know, the players sell the games. It's not the managers, it's not the referees, it's not the administrators. And the fact that, for all intents and purposes, footballers and hurlers are kept under lock and key for 99% of the season does the GAA a disservice. It does the general public a disservice, because I have not yet heard a small child say, I'm off out to the garden to imitate the county secretary or the county PRO or one of the managers. They're out to try and imitate some of the players, and I think putting them front and centre with the media would serve the GAA very well, and it would also serve the players very well.
It has to be a concern though, just given the fact that we don't know the players, and I know that's something that you outline here as well, that we don't get to see them. We look at every other sport and there's TikToks and YouTubes and Instagrams, and they have huge media access. The NFL being one, the NBA, all the big sports really have a much more developed and appreciative relationship, I think, with the media as well.
Yeah, they understand what they're trying to do. And it's ironic that GAA inter-county teams try to depict themselves as being professional in everything, and yet the one time they play the amateur card is with the media. If you were in the NFL, you'd be in the locker room after a game interviewing players. I'm sure most managers would fall down in a weakness if you propose that for the hurling and football teams. Absolutely. But, you know, the argument is always made, well, these guys, rugby and soccer players, are professionals, so that's baked into their duties in their contract. But surely the argument is, if the GAA is in competition with professional sports, there's an onus on it to be more proactive in promoting its own sport. And that is in encouraging players to participate in media duties and to spread the gospel of the game. If they're not being paid to play, why are they playing? They're playing for the enjoyment. And surely they would like to spread that enjoyment and encourage others to participate also.
You've brought us nicely along to the very thorny and delicate issue of payment for managers, and also the amateurism as well, and how long it's going to be called an amateur organisation when you do look at all the amount of people that are being paid in it, players aside. How do you see that going?
Well, let's be honest. If you're a doctor or a physiotherapist or a dietitian providing professional services in an above the board, you know, capacity, I don't think anyone has an issue with you being paid for your professional expertise. People have an issue, or should have an issue, or should have more of an issue with the fact that there are millions of euros sloshing around the country in illegal payments to managers who run the circuit. And what was really striking with the book was that every single person I asked about it acknowledged the size of that problem. Nobody kicked back and said, Michael, you're exaggerating there. That's not really an issue. It's a huge problem. And the fact that it's been allowed to fester to the extent that the GAA is now considering trying to legislate for it and legitimise it shows just how deep that problem has taken root. And to me, I would have to say it is the single most pressing threat against the GAA's future.
You do elaborate on that as well, and you have a chapter on it, but it's really hard to look at maybe the past, and even if you look at football clubs like League of Ireland clubs and the way things have gone with them over time, and consider the economy that we have, and who knows what's coming down the track. Do you think that we'll have an economy there that could sustain it at all in the future?
I can't see how an economy, and this popped up actually when I wrote GAA Economics about paying players, and the point I made then was I'm not sure how anyone could propose that with a straight face in an economy where literally banks were closing down. And if anyone actually thinks that you could sustain professional GAA clubs, I would point them not even to the League of Ireland, but to professional rugby, which has four teams, and one of which is regularly threatened with extinction, Connacht. So how people think 32 football and maybe 12 hurling teams could be sustained in counties as small as, say, Leitrim and Louth, with the population base and the economics of that country. Like, by all means, show me the figures. I'd be delighted to have a look at them, but I just don't think they exist.
How did you get people to talk to you, by the way?
Very easily. Just ask them. And some people were a bit nervous about it and didn't want to participate, which is fine. You can't force them. But What I find, to be fair, I know people have an issue sometimes with the conservatism of the GAA, but the likes of Tom Ryan and Peter McKenna have a refreshing attitude in the sense that, well, look, if we can't articulate our vision of where things are and where they're going, then what are we at? And I think maybe if some of the county managers and players who take their lead from more secretive people were to follow their lead, the whole organisation would be in a far better place.
Are you worried about the future of the GAA?
I would be, in so far as I'm not sure how long this can continue, the current situation. I mean, was it last year? Was it over 43 million was declared as inter-county spending? Now, I'm not saying there's 43 million going sloshing around into clubs and counties off the books, but that can't be sustained. And as long as you have that double think where you're kind of rubbing along and not enough people, a critical mass of people, aren't annoyed enough to do anything, that is a threat to the GAA. And I think what I would be worried about would be a county board being pulled in by the revenue commissioners, having their real books exposed, and what would happen then to that unit of the GAA, and what would be the implications for the rest of the GAA of that happening.
The facilities, though, and maintaining them, they are expensive. And that brings me onto amalgamation and when that is going to happen. We had the Camogie president, Brian Malloy, in recently, and I put it to him about it potentially costing 500 million. He said that was nonsense. What are your thoughts on it?
See, I think that figure is kind of getting folded in with a general kind of infrastructural redevelopment. Mm-hmm. You know, to be fair, I think it's wrong to say it's going to cost 500 million to put, you know, kind of showers for women in every club in Ireland or whatever. You know, that's not the case, obviously. I think that's where that figure comes from. And it won't be long getting up to 500 million. But I think that's a bit of a misrepresentation. Obviously, if Semple Stadium, to take an obvious example, has to be renovated, that should be done with an eye to making it more accessible to more teams, which is the natural result of integration. But you can't really say, to me, you can't really say, well, you know, the integration piece is what's really driving up the costs. I think Irish building costs are what is driving, are what will drive up that cost.
And do you think it'll get done, though? Like, given everything you know about the GAA, and I know it's a timeline that's fast approaching, it's only 2 years' time. Do you think that they're going to get there?
It just strikes me as a little bit optimistic. I mean, I would have thought at this stage you would have had some kind of concrete markers of progress. And so far it seems either to be quite aspirational, or you have the case where the Camogie president is saying that Gerald Burns' comments are nonsense, which is not the kind of messaging you would expect from organisations which are kind of coming closer together. If anything, that looks to me like they're drifting further apart. I'd love to see some kind of concrete markers where, look, we've decided this is going to be the management structure, this is going to be the name, this is going to be how we're going to organise fixtures, and that seems to be quite a way off still.
The other thing that always interests me when it comes to the GAA and what might look like in the future, and again, it's probably looking at other sports in Ireland like athletics and football and the new Ireland and the role that that the GAA can play in it. Do you see the GAA playing a bigger role?
I think it's funny that I suppose when you're talking about kind of newcomers to Ireland, it's natural that they would gravitate towards sports they're immediately familiar with, like, you know, soccer, maybe rugby to a lesser extent, and athletics and so on. I think the messaging from the GAA probably should be more proactive. I do know when I wrote GAA Economics that one of the contributors pointed out that the Gaelic part of Gaelic Athletic Association in research was found to be a little bit of an obstacle, in the sense that some of the newcomers to the country thought that was some kind of qualification, that you had to be Irish to participate in the sports. Now, I think at this stage that should be well and truly kind of discarded. But certainly, you know, it is, you know, such a community oriented and embedded organisation that you would be hopeful that it would be one of the prime kind of instruments of integrating people into Irish life.
And with rural Ireland changing as well, just in terms of population, is the GAA, and it has been spoken about quite a lot of late, is the GAA under threat in rural Ireland?
I would say there's a lot of institutions under threat in rural Ireland. In terms of, is there going to be a club in every parish to the extent we've always been used to? I'm not so sure, because, you know, you go up and down the West Coast and places aren't actually denuded, but there are so many holiday homes, for instance, that you don't really have a population to pick from. You know, one of the horrifying stats was when I spoke to Pat Spillane, he pointed out an area in South Kerry the size of Louth, which can't field a minor team between four or five clubs. Now, you know, the remedy for that is a higher birth rate. But if people, A, aren't living there, and B, by the way, can't get planning permission to build houses, then that has an impact. Now, that's, if you like, an unintended consequence of chaos in the planning system, that GAA clubs are struggling. But I suppose it illustrates how the GAA is embedded in Irish life, but also how developments and changes in Irish life have a huge impact on it.
Pat Spillane says that it's a book to start a thousand debates. And it definitely is when you go through it, because everybody has differing views on so many things, and you cover them all, really. Is there something that you love talking about?
Look, nothing beats talking about the games themselves. I mean, you know, you can find funding interesting and building facilities, etc. But actually talking about the games and the changes in the games and the future changes in the games. Like when Tom Ryan says, you know, why should it be 15 a side? What if it were 13 a side? You know, that would be hugely interesting just in terms of how the games would develop tactically in terms of skills, etc. You know, nothing, it's like the GAA itself, nothing beats the games.
GAA Go is another thing that you explore as well. Are we comfortable with it now, do you think?
To be fair, and it's not because of where I'm speaking at the moment, I think RT was kind of unlucky in the sense that it was caught in a wide... GAA Go was part of a wider firestorm, I think is how Declan McBennett referred to it. I think he's right. There were some unfortunate circumstances that kind of weaponized the entire debate. I think a lot of politicians now, looking back, would want to be a little bit embarrassed with the posturing they had about it, because as he rightly points out, it was probably more of a national broadband issue than a national broadcasting issue. But, you know, the fact that you had the JNRT on kind of two sides of the one negotiating table was something that couldn't be sustained, and it hasn't been. And in fairness, as Declan said, if everybody knew that Cork Limerick down the park in 2024 was going to be a classic game, he said it'd be great to know all the classic games in advance and we could plan accordingly.
Of course. Michael, it's great. Like, it just gives so much food for thought, and it feels like a really important time to write this book as well. And I hope you'll be doing plenty of follow-ups now over the next few years as well, as we try and navigate and figure out what the future of Gaelic games looks like.
Thanks a million, Marie.
Game on. GAA.
Now we're turning our attention back to football. Paul Corry is still in studio. Paul, there is some team news from Liverpool.
Yeah, the big news, Marie, is that Alexander Isak is going to start for his full debut for Liverpool. So their starting 11 is Alisson in goals. Back four, Frimpong, Konate, Van Dijk and Robertson. So no Kirkes. Middle three of Szoboszlai, Gravenberch and Wirtz. And a front three then of Salah, Isak and Gakpo. So that will be interesting. I thought he might only play 30 minutes tonight, maybe blood him then for 60 minutes in the next game with the view of getting him in from the start. But obviously seen enough and feel he's sharp enough to go from the get-go tonight.
Okay, well, there is no change in those two early games. It is still scoreless between Olympiacos and Paphos, and Slavia Prague are leading Bodø/Glimt by 1-2. And that is all we have time for. I'm going to be back here on 2FM tomorrow from 6 o'clock. Paul will be here to look back on all this Champions League action as well. And Rebecca Cray will join us to talk football. Lots of football action. Bernard Jackman will be in studio with rugby news. We're going to have the latest from the World Athletics Championships as well. And Jeff Shepherd has his eye on America. Stay with us on 2FM. Up next is the new music show.
This is 2FM.